This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Teresa Schoetz. She's the daughter of Russell Maroon Schoetz, who's been in prison under solitary confinement for 21 years. This is an in-depth interview that explores some of the reasons for Russell's confinement. We'll hear excerpts from Glenn Greenwald speaking at a Chicago conference titled Challenging the Surveillance State. Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Tying into reports we've done over the years on secret rendition, the European Parliament recently adopted a report by its Civil Liberties Committee calling on European Union member states to look into whether there were secret prisons or facilities on their territory where people were held under the CIA secret rendition program in the early years of this century. In particular, Lithuania, Poland, and Romania are being encouraged to open or resume independent investigations. In part, the report says, the European Parliament has again shone the spotlight on serious human rights abuses by the CIA and delivered a rebuke to those EU member states complicit in these abuses. Research by the United Nations, the Council of Europe, national and international media, investigative journalists, and civil society has brought to light new information on the location of secret CIA detention sites in Europe, rendition flights through European airspace, and persons transported or detained. The report calls on Finland, Denmark, Portugal, Italy, the UK, Germany, Spain, Ireland, Greece, Cyprus, Romania, and Poland to disclose all information on suspect planes associated with the CIA and their territory. In an update that connects to our next guest, the ACLU of Idaho recently reached an agreement with Canyon County officials to settle a federal class action lawsuit brought in late 2011. The lawsuit had claimed that staff at the county jail were retaliating against inmates who exercised their First Amendment right to file grievances with county officials and with the courts. The documents allege that prisoners were put in solitary confinement or even transferred to other jails if they complained about poor conditions in the jail. One of the plaintiffs, Lorraine Scott, said she was put in solitary after submitting a grievance, and that when she was released from isolation, a guard said to her if she filed another one, she'd be returned to solitary. The settlement will result in Canyon County creating a written policy assuring zero tolerance for retaliatory action by jail officers against inmates. And within 90 days of the court settlement, the county is going to conduct a training session with all officers having contact with prisoners at the jail, including administration, about the retaliation policy. Training with staff will be conducted annually by a lawyer in the Canyon County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. This will directly connect to our next guest. Last year, the National Lawyers Guild called on Superintendent Louis Foligno to support the Program Review Board's recommendation to release Russell Maroon Schoetz into general population at SCI Green in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. As many listeners may recall, Russell Schoetz has been held as a political prisoner under intense lockdown, spending no more than 1 hour a day outside of his cell for the past 21 years. He was locked up in 1972, related to his activity as a member of the Black Liberation Army. We follow up on the international campaign earlier this year to release Schoetz. The effort was launched in New York City and London and sponsored by the Scientific Soul Sessions. We're joined today by Russell Schoetz's daughter, Teresa, a Philadelphia-based prison justice activist. Teresa, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks for having me.
Your father has been in solitary confinement for 21 years, and I understand that he was just denied release again into general population. Can you tell us roughly how many times he's appeared before the review board, what his status is, why he's there?
He goes before the Program Review Board every 90 days. And it's about at least 68 visits since he's been in solitary confinement. What we're looking at is he hasn't had any infractions in 30 years.
So he's had a clean record.
He's had a clean record, so it looks as if they're just rubber stamping him. Every 90 days, he's told to maintain the same manner, the same behavior in which he has shown within the last 30 years, and that's been without any infraction. So when you look at that, there's some signs there that they don't intend to release him into the general population.
Does he literally appear before the board in person?
Yes, he does.
And do they ask him questions?
I'm not sure of all the questions, but from what Russell tells me is that it's like a checkoff in reference to what your behavior has been. How is your response when a guard comes to your cell? What's your response when you're taken to the shower? And he hasn't had not one bad word to a guard, let alone any outrageous actions towards the guard. It's just the same checklist. And Russell had one time got disappointed with this program review committee every 90 days and said, I'm not going anymore. And I said, I don't know, we better think about that. So I called the director of the program review committee there at SCI Green. And I said, you know, we're getting tired of this same ongoing no movement forward towards putting him in population. I said, I don't think Russell Shokes wants to come to your program review committee anymore. He said, I wouldn't do that. He said, I suggest that he comes to every 90-day hearing, because if he doesn't, we look down on that. We look at that as him not cooperating with the prison. We look at it as the family members and supporters that you're not cooperating. You're not working in accordance to this hearing and all the rules that you set forth prisoners to be released back into population. There is a step-down program out of solitary confinement.
Meaning a program that helps you get out of solitary, transition back into general?
Right. And they don't use it as much as they should. What we're finding is within the last 2 years, they have released some guys from solitary confinement in the same prison where Maroon is, where Russell is.
Which is SCI Green.
SCI Green. It's only been in reference to the state budget.
What do you mean by that?
When you talk about holding one prisoner in solitary confinement, he has to be transferred back and forth, whatever his movement, to the shower, to that 1 hour cage, as they call it, exercise room. It takes two guards. Now, when you look into general population, the capacity of the prisoners, the guards who supervise these prisoners, there could be one guard on a site with at least 100 to 200 prisoners. But every prisoner in confinement, solitary confinement, has to be moved about with two guards.
It's much more expensive.
Much more expensive. So what SCI Green did was to release a lot of prisoners within the last 2 years. It's been more than 20 released from solitary confinement who they had no intentions of releasing. But because the state budget is in jeopardy now, they did a step-down program. They introduced a step-down where some prisoners were transferred to Camp Hill, SCI Camp Hill in Pennsylvania. They're supposed to, if they act accordingly and follow this program, I don't know what it all entails. It may be getting your GED completed. Some of these guys have been promised to be moved closer to home, closer to a prison that's closer to their family.
Teresa, that makes me wonder, How many people at SCI Green, and you may not know this, but I'd like to sort of research this, how many are at any one time being held in solitary?
You know, I'm not sure the numbers, but I think I can remember Daddy said it was about at least 60. They release more than half of those guys into that step-down program because of the budget, but they left Daddy back there. Daddy, being approaching 70 years of age, hasn't had an infraction in 30 years. You would have thought that he would have been the perfect prisoner for this step-down program. And we question that when we see the release of these prisoners into the step-down program because of the budget deficit. And we were told that Russell would be given a mopping job on the solitary confinement unit, which never came about.
Now, let's clarify for our listeners. When someone is given a job, that obviously is a vote of confidence in terms of security that that person can be trusted.
Exactly. But this is the key to this job that they were going to give him. It had never been done before. See, we're talking about a restricted housing unit, which is actually the 23-hour lockdown solitary confinement. There's never been a job on those units, not at SCI Green. Russell Schultz would have been the first to mop that unit as a prisoner holding a job on the unit. They were also looking at Russell to be this example to other prisoners, that if Russell, if we can hold him 30 years in solitary confinement, you can be released at some point also. Mm-hmm. If you have to currently. Now, does it take 30 years for this to happen? But this is what's their excuse. We will give him a job, and he can show some of the other guys on the unit how to act accordingly, and then maybe one day they'll be released from solitary confinement.
But if he had that job, he'd still be in solitary.
He would still be in solitary. It was part of their step down.
He would be
let out of the cell, maybe an hour or two to mop the unit, and then placed back in solitary confinement. And that would be to see how this works out, stepping down.
I see. Now, you're making me go back a number of years, and I think this sort of ties it all together, because Russell escaped many years ago.
30 years.
And some have suggested that he's being held in solitary at SCI Green because the current warden of that facility does not want any chance of another escape on that warden's record. Do you think there's truth to that?
Very much so. The warden at SCI Green is Superintendent Foligno. I'm going to give you three of my reasons why I think Foligno stated that Russell had escaped, but in response to that, we came back with, but he was sentenced to your prison only for 9 years for solitary confinement. Three-panel judge said, well, we'll put him in solitary only for 9 years at your prison because this is a new supermax prison. Let's see how he does 9 years. We don't expect him to escape because it's really supermax. Foligno continued the solitary confinement. For one, I don't think he wants this on his watch. The second thing is he's told me in the past that Maroon may escape. And we told him, that, why would he? And your prison is supermax. And this is why he was transferred there. The other thing is concern for his staff. He said, my staff, I have to be concerned about their safety. Well, when I talk to staff there and a number of the guards who bring Russell in, when I visit, they all say he needs to be in population. This man is not going to harm anyone. He's been one of the nicest people we've known. He's one of the most laid-back, mild-mannered folks that we have to deal with. I don't see a threat to him. And now, this is personally what guards have told me and my family members during our visits. Now, I kind of look at this too. Superintendent Foligno may retire in 2 years. And I just think he wants to slide on out without releasing Maroon into population.
Years ago, after Russell did escape and was returned to prison, he was actually in general population, not once, but twice.
Maroon escaped 1977, in the 80s. He had been in population. He was at SCI Pittsburgh. He was in population. He had been voted the first black president of the Lifers Association. Now, we're talking about him being at SCI Pittsburgh. It's a rural area. They had never had a black president to run the Lifers group. And Maroon was voted the first black president. Well, the warden of that prison said, take it back. Take the vote back. He came to the block and asked the inmates to do another vote. And the inmates said no. He said, well, Russell will not be your first black president. Well, the prisoners took a stand, and they went on a hunger strike. They even filed a lawsuit in reference to them being able to vote and they all have their own rights, their own statement, and they stayed on a hunger strike. During that hunger strike is when Maroon was transferred to SCI Green. Russell, at one time, here in Pennsylvania, Camp Hill Prison had an uprising, and the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections thought the best thing to be, although Russell was not at SCI Camp Hill Prison during this uprising at Camp Hill, they thought it best to transfer him outside of a state prison to a federal prison, and they transferred him all the way to Marion Prison, which is a federal prison, which I don't even think is legal to transfer a state prisoner to a federal prison. Okay, when he gets to Marion, the papers that came with Maroon stated that he should be locked down in 23-hour population. But after an evaluation at this federal prison, he was evaluated and deemed eligible to be in population, and he stayed in population until he was transferred back to the state prisons here in Pennsylvania.
And roughly how long was that he was in general?
It's about a year, I think, he stayed in Marion.
Russell has been in general population, no infractions, and then has been returned to solitary. It sounds, from what you've described, that he was punished for his natural leadership abilities.
Now, that is one of the Superintendent Foligno's fears. Foligno states that he is a leader and that he is to remain in solitary. The director of the Program Review Committee actually stated that Russell is a leader. Now, I called him back to be sure that I heard this properly, and I had an attorney on the phone. Actually, it was King Downing. I said, I have an attorney on the phone. And he said, I don't care. He said, everything I stated is the truth. Russell is a leader. So I said, so you understand you're saying that he's in solitary confinement because he's a leader? He said, yes, I'll say it again, he's a leader. He said, obviously, Teresa, you don't know your dad. You don't know he's a leader? I said, well, what I do know about him is that he's a grandfather. He's approaching 70 years of age, and he hasn't had any infractions in 30 years. And they justified it because outside of him being a leader, he's been able to withstand this 23-hour lockdown. But I do see that there are some changes with Russell, and I'm talking emotionally. He's very distraught now. He's very stressed. I'm shocked that he hasn't broken just totally down. One thing I think that keeps him going, of course, I'm not there in the cell 23 hours a day. I can't imagine being there, is that his wheels are constantly turning because he gets a lot of mail. He's involved in a lot of organizational duties outside of the prison. So therefore, he's constantly busy through letter writings and participating and helping folks outside of the prison. But when you look at that type of confinement and researching SCI Green's prison, I found that there have been a number of suicides in the SCI Green Solitary Confinement Unit, boys in their 20s hanging themselves because of that type of treatment. You know, this is torture. When you look at it, we are condoning. I mean, these prisons have taken in, I can go back to, I think, 05. There were at least 80,000 people in solitary confinement throughout Pennsylvania. Now, we're looking at young boys that's coming from general neighborhoods, get placed in solitary confinement, and they may act out because they're not used to this type of confinement, and all it does is add on more time that you're punished and you're forced to stay in a 23-hour lockdown, to whereas a lot of these young boys coming in off the street cannot handle. I mean, most folks, I don't even look at it as just these young boys coming in off the street who are confined in these units who can't handle this type of torture. I couldn't handle it. Outside of that stuff, when we talk about the number of youth who have hung themselves in solitary confinement, you don't hear about it.
No, of course you don't hear about it because the prisons don't want this information to get out to the general public. It's a very secret method of torture, which leads us to the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, who is aware of Russell's situation.
Yes, very much aware of what's going on with Russell. And he's been very helpful. He's filed complaint on Russell's behalf. And we're just waiting for his word back. His office has submitted Russell's complaint to his Geneva office. And after that, he'll submit it to representatives here in the United States. The only thing with that is we don't know much of what's going on now since he submitted the application to his Geneva office on Maroon's behalf. Most of this stuff is confidential until he bottom lines everything, and then he sends just his report to representatives in Washington, D.C. here in the state. So we don't have any feedback yet, but what we do know is that the family, my family, Russell's family, has properly submitted the application to Juan Mendez. And he took it up. They're working on it. We're just looking forward to how they're going to bottom line everything. And with him taking a stand, with the rapporteur taking a stand and taking on Maroon's case, we're hoping that this will make a big difference. You know, for me, it's already made a difference because here we have a person who not only is here in the States, but has office in Geneva who have acknowledged that this type of torture is wrong. So visiting professor now here in the States, but if you look up on Juan Mendez's report online, it is to the point. He has some facts there that are astonishing. It amazed me that we continue to do this.
Teresa, we only have a few minutes left, but I want to talk briefly as we end about your own activism around your father's case. Tell us what you do on a day-to-day basis.
Well, with the prison system in general, there's a whole lot to do. My focus is for Maroon to be placed in the population. So I'm not only concerned with stopping the expansion of prisons being built, because there's millions of dollars going to build new prisons instead of those millions being used to educate the prisoners or train the prisoners who are being released, or to put that money back into the public schools instead of building new prisons. There's so much work to do I'm working against that. I'm working to free folks from solitary confinement. I'm working to keep our youth out of prison. I've become a foster parent since February 2012. I've had four teenagers in my home, one four-month-old baby, and now I have a six-year-old. So my job is big because we're being assaulted by this present-day prison system, and our government nor our state seems to mind locking up folks or taking away monies from our public school education to put into prison. So my job is big. I would advise other folks to get involved. We definitely need the family members of prisoners to be more involved in what's going on. Here you talk about 2 million plus people in prison. If you just took half of those family members to take a stand, we would be a force that no one could touch. So when you talk about my job is double duties, because we don't have enough folks who seem to care about what's going on in this present-day prison system. I do want to acknowledge that Dick Durbin did something extraordinary by calling a congressional hearing on solitary confinement.
That hearing was last month, I understand.
Right, last month. I can't remember that date. But Dick Durbin, he did something extraordinary, and that was to call attention to solitary confinement. And he called a congressional hearing. It was held in Washington, D.C. It was excellent. It placed the solitary confinement thing on the map with our legislators who don't care about people in prison. They really don't. They think there's a crime being committed, they should be locked up. And that's just not all of the facts. Back in 1980, we began this big expansion of solitary confinement units, and we went crazy haywire, real crazy, in building Supermax solitary confinement unit. And that was back in the 80s. It took this long for someone to step forward and said, enough is enough. So I admire Dick Durbin for taking this stand, making his other folks in Washington, D.C. aware of what's going on.
Teresa, if people would like to help with your father's case, where do they go for information?
Okay, we're asking folks to go to HRC.org, the Human Rights Coalition group here in Philadelphia, and HRC FedUp, which is located in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My number here is 267-456-7882. I'm so pressed and so desperate about freeing Maroon that I've been giving out my personal cell phone number. So HRC.org is this place to go. And we also have a blog, RussellMaroonShoots.wordpress.com.
Teresa, you have a huge heart. You're one of the hardest workers I know, and you've dedicated your life to social justice. Let's see if we can't get you some help out there.
Thank you so much.
We'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. We go now to listen to an excerpt from a presentation by Glenn Greenwald. Glenn is an author and lawyer who has worked as a constitutional and civil rights litigator before becoming a contributor, columnist, and blogger to Salon.com. During his book tour for the release of With Liberty and Justice for Some, he gave a speech in Chicago titled Challenging the Surveillance State. Let's have a listen.
And it's not just the government that is engaged in surveillance, but just as menacingly, corporations, private corporations, engage in huge amount of surveillance on us. They give us cell phones that track every moment where we are physically, and then provide that to law enforcement agencies without so much as a search warrant. Obviously, credit card and banking transactions are recorded and tell anyone who wants to know everything that we do. When we talk about the scandal of the Bush eavesdropping program, that was not really a government eavesdropping program so much as it was a private industry eavesdropping program. It was done with the direct and full cooperation of AT&T, Sprint, Verizon, and the other telecom giants. In fact, when you talk about the American surveillance state, what you're really talking about is no longer public government agencies. What you're talking about is a full-scale merger between the federal government and industry. That is what the surveillance state is. They are equally important parts of what the surveillance state does. I think the most interesting and probably revealing example that I can give you about where we are in terms of surveillance in the United States was a really ironic and unintendedly amusing series of events that took place in mid-2011. What happened in mid-2011 was that the governments of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which, as we know, are very, very oppressive and hate freedom, they said that what they were going to do was ban the use of BlackBerries and similar devices on their soil. And the reason is that the corporation that produces BlackBerry was either unable or unwilling to guarantee that Saudi and UAE intelligence agencies would be able to intercept all communications. And the governments of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates were horrified by the prospect that people might be able to communicate on their soil without them being able to intercept and surveil that communication, and in response, they banned BlackBerries. And this created huge amounts of condemnation in the Western world. Every American newspaper editorialized about how this showed how much these governments were the enemies of freedom. The Obama administration issued a stinging denunciation of both governments, saying that they were engaged in the kinds of oppression that we couldn't tolerate. And yet, 6 weeks later, the New York Times reported that the Obama administration was preparing legislation to mandate that all services that enable communications, I'm quoting from the New York Times, to mandate that all services that enable communications, including encrypted email transmitters like BlackBerry, social networking websites like Facebook, and software that allows direct peer-to-peer messaging like Skype, be designed to ensure government surveillance. It was exactly the same principle that everybody condemned the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia for. The principle being that there can be no human interaction, especially no human communication, not just from foreign nationals and between foreign nationals, but by American citizens on American soil that is beyond the reach of the US government. This was the mindset that in 2002 led the Bush administration to dredge up John Poindexter from wherever it was that he was. They worked for defense contractors, and they dredged him up, and he was going to start the program that they called the Total Information Awareness Program. And the logo, which I actually looked at in the last couple of weeks that you should go and look at, just because you won't believe how creepy it is, has a pyramid with this huge eye hovering over it. This eye that was going to be the all-seeing eye. And the only problem with the Total Information Awareness Program was that they just put a name on it that was too honest about what it was. It freaked everybody out, and so they had to pretend that they weren't going to go forward with it. But of course, what they did was they incrementally and in very clear ways recreated the Total Information Awareness Program under a whole variety of different legislative initiatives. And this idea that every single form of technological communication by law must be constructed to permit government backdoor interception and surveillance is an expression of what this surveillance state mindset is, that there can be no such thing as any form of privacy from the US government. That is the mindset that has led the surveillance state to be this sprawling, vast, ubiquitous and always expanding instrument that state and corporate power users employ in order to safeguard their power. But one other point that's worth making about how this works, about how the surveillance state works and how power is exercised through it, and this I think is probably the most pernicious part, and I refer to this as the one-way mirror, the government's one-way mirror. At exactly the same time, this is really so remarkable to me, at exactly the same time that the government has been massively expanding its ability to know everything that we're doing, it has simultaneously erected a wall of secrecy around it that prevents us from knowing anything that they're doing. There was this amazing controversy when the documents from WikiLeaks were disclosed and the American media had to rush to assure everybody simultaneously that this was both a completely meaningless act and a completely horrible act. So the two claims that were made was this horrible, traitorous organization, WikiLeaks, has severely damaged American national security, but at the same time, we want you to know there's nothing new in anything that they disclose. There's nothing worth knowing. That was literally the two claims that were made, and nobody ever bothered to reconcile those. But what was true is that of the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pages that WikiLeaks disclosed, it's actually in excess of a million now, there were the vast, vast bulk of it were very banal content. It was stuff that really wasn't particularly interesting, that didn't reveal very much about anything that was worth knowing. And what was actually so scandalous about that was that very fact, because every single page that WikiLeaks disclosed was stamped classified, and it made a crime to disclose any of it, even though so much of it was banal and revealed nothing worth knowing. And what that reflected is that the US government reflexively labels everything that it does of any conceivable significance as classified and secret. It keeps everything that it does from us at the very same time that it knows more and more about what we're doing. And if you think about how warped that is, what a radical reversal of how things are supposed to work, it's really startling. The idea is supposed to be, and this is just basic political science, basic design of the founding, that there's supposed to be transparency for government. We're supposed to know virtually everything that they do. Individuals are supposed to live in a sphere of privacy. Nobody's supposed to know what we're doing unless there's a demonstrated good reason to invade that wall of privacy. We completely reversed that so that the government now operates with complete secrecy and we have none. Governments, when they want to give themselves abusive and radical powers, typically first target people who they think their citizens won't care very much about because they'll think they're not affected by it. And that's pretty much what happened. We detained without charges and without trials a bunch of Muslims who remained nameless, who we picked up in places that nobody really knew about or cared much about. We sent drones to assassinate them. All of these powers that were directed at foreign others. But what has happened over the last 3 to 4 years is a radical change in the war on terror. The war on terror has now been imported into United States policy. It is now directed at American citizens on American soil. So rather than simply sending drones to assassinate foreign nationals, we are now sending drones to target and kill American citizens without charges or trial. Rather than indefinitely detaining foreign nationals at Guantanamo, Congress last year enacted and President Obama signed the National Defense Authorization Act that permits the detention without trial indefinitely of American citizens on U.S. soil. Rather than sending drones only over Yemen and Somalia and Pakistan, drones are now being approved at an alarming rate, not just surveillance drones, but increasingly, possibly, weaponized drones that will fly over American soil, watching everything that we do in ways that, say, police helicopters could never possibly accomplish. Even when President Obama promised to close Guantanamo, and lots of his defenders will say, not inaccurately, that he was prevented from doing so because Congress blocked the closure, the plan that he had was not to close Guantanamo and eliminate the system of indefinite detention that made it so controversial. The plan was to take that system of indefinite detention, close Guantanamo because it had become an upsetting symbol, and import it, move it onto American soil. Plan that the Obama administration had for indefinite detention. And so what you see is this gradual importation of all of the abuses of the war on terror so that now they are entrenched and not just aimed at foreign nationals, but U.S. citizens on U.S. soil as well. That's the mechanism by which this is being done. If you listen to U.S. officials, intelligence and defense officials, talk about terrorism, what they emphasize now is not Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, which they'll largely acknowledge has been eliminated, or even Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which isn't really much of a threat to anybody. What they'll talk about is the threat of homegrown terrorism. This is now the grave menace that American terrorism officials will warn needs to be restrained, and the solution to that has been the gradual transference of all of these abuses that we let take root because they weren't happening to us but were happening to people over there and are now being imported into domestic powers. And the reason that that's being done is not very difficult to see. American policymakers know that the financial unraveling that took place in 2008, that's even more visible in European states like Spain and Portugal and Greece, has never really been rectified, and it can't be rectified because these are structural problems. The way in which oligarchs in the United States monopolize wealth and then use that wealth to control our political processes ensure that this is not going to change. It's only going to worsen. Mass unemployment, mass foreclosure, all of these income inequality pathologies are here to stay, and the future that American policymakers see is visible if you look at what happened in London for a brief period of time, what happens all the time in Athens, what is happening with increasing frequency in Spain, huge amounts of social unrest. And you see lots of that happening. I think that's what the Occupy movement in many ways is. And the elites in the United States, both corporate and government, are petrified about that type of unrest. And what people in power always do when they fear unrest is they start consolidating power in order to constrain it, in order to suppress it. And this is what this surveillance state is designed to do. It's justified in the name of terrorism, of course, that's the packaging in which it's wrapped, but it's been used extremely and in all sorts of ways since 9/11 for domestic application. And that's happening even more. It's happening in terms of the Occupy movement and the infiltration that federal officials were able to accomplish using Patriot Act authorities. It's happened with pro-Palestinian activists in the United States and all other dissident groups that have themselves targeted with surveillance and law enforcement used by what was originally these war on terror powers. And I just want to close by talking about why I think this matters, because the attitude that you will typically encounter, and it's not a very easy mindset to address or to refute, is that, and it's one that government has sold continuously and peddled, which is, well, privacy in the abstract, I can understand why it's something to value, but ultimately, if I'm not really doing anything wrong, if I'm not one of the terrorists, if I'm not plotting to bomb a bridge, I don't really have much reason to care if people are invading my sphere of privacy and watching and learning what it is that I'm doing. And so I think it's worth talking about the reasons why that is such an ill-advised way to think, why it absolutely matters that privacy is being invaded in these systematic ways. I mean, one obvious answer is that any kind of social movement needs to be able to organize in private, away from the targets of the organization. So, the revolutionary movements in the Arab world, one of the greatest challenges that they had was that the government sought all sorts of ways to prevent them from communicating from one another, either at all or in privacy. And the fact that the internet was not nearly as pervasive in those countries actually turned out to be a blessing because it enabled them to organize in more organic ways. But if the government is able to learn what we speak about and know who we're talking to and know what it is that we're planning, it makes any kind of activism extremely difficult because secrecy and privacy are prerequisites to effective activism. But I think the more difficult value of privacy, the one that's a lot harder to think about, is also the one that's much more important than just the one I described. And that is that it is in the private realm, exclusively, where things like dissent and creativity and challenges to orthodoxy reside. It's only when you know that you can explore without external judgment, or you can experiment without eyes being cast upon you? Is the opportunity for creating new paths possible? And there are all kinds of fascinating studies that prove this to be the case. There are psychological studies where people have sat down at their dinner table with family members or friends, and they are talking for a long time in a very informal way, and then suddenly one of them pulls out a tape recorder and puts it on the table and says, I'm going to tape record our conversation just for my own interest. I promise I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm not going to show it to anybody. No one's ever going to hear it. I'm just going to tape record it because I'd like to go over all the wisdom that you give me. And it's an experiment psychologically to assess what the impact of that is. And invariably what happens is people who are now being recorded radically change their behavior. They speak in much more stilted and stilted sentences. They try and talk about much more high-minded topics. They're much stiffer in their expression of things because they now feel like they're being monitored. There was a pilot program in Los Angeles 6 or 7 years ago that was in response to a couple of exaggerated news stories about rambunctious school children, elementary age school children on buses who had apparently been bullying and abusing other students. And the solution that they came up with was that they were going to install surveillance cameras in every single public school bus in Los Angeles County, which is the second or third largest county in the United States. And the response when it was ultimately disclosed was, well, this is going to be extraordinarily expensive. I mean, how can you have tens of thousands of working surveillance cameras with people monitoring them or recording them every single day for every school bus in Los Angeles County? And the answer that they gave was, oh no, we're not going to have working cameras in these buses. There may be a few buses that have working cameras, just so nobody knows which buses have those. We're going to have faux cameras. Because we know that if we put cameras up, even though they're not working, that will radically change the behavior of students. In other words, we are training our young citizens to live in a culture where they expect that they are always being watched. And we want them to be chilled, and we want them to be deterred. We want them not to ever challenge orthodoxy or to explore limits or engage in creativity of any kind. This type of surveillance, by design, breeds conformism. That's its purpose. And that's what makes this surveillance so pernicious. Now, the last point I want to make is one of the things that about the surveillance state is one of the things that happens is that the way in which it affects how people think and behave is typically insidious. It's something that's very potent, and yet it's very easy to avoid understanding or realizing, even as it affects you. Now, sometimes people do know about the effects of the surveillance state and the climate of fear it creates, and it affects them. I went on a book tour last October and early November, and I went to 15 different cities, and in each of the cities I really didn't care honestly about the book events. I was much more interested in going to the Occupy encampments in each city and spending time there. It was much more enlightening and energizing. One of the things that would happen is, literally almost the entirety of my book tour was taken up by talking about the Occupy movement. It was what everyone was thinking about. I had written many times that I thought it was by far the most significant political development in many years, and I still think that. And everywhere I would go that I would talk about the Occupy movement, literally all the time I would get people who would say things like, and I would be on radio shows and people would call in and say this, they would say, look, I'm really supportive of the Occupy movement. I want to go down there and be a participant in it, but I'm a woman who has a small baby, or I'm a man who has a bad leg, and given all the police abuse that's taken place there and all the infiltration, I'm just afraid of going and participating in these movements. That was definitely part of the effect that this infiltration and the police abuse had. It created this climate of fear in a way that people knew. I spend a lot of time with American Muslims and in American Muslim communities because of what I do and the work that I do and where I go and speak. And one of the things that emboldens me and keeps me very energized and engaged about these issues is if you go and speak to communities of American Muslims, what you'll find is an incredibly pervasive climate of fear. And the reason is that they know that they are always being watched. They know that they have FBI informants who are attempting to infiltrate their communities. They know that they have people next to them, their neighbors, their fellow Moscowers who have been manipulated by the FBI to be informants. They know that they are being eavesdropped on when they speak on the telephone. They know that they are having their emails read when they speak or communicate to anybody. And what they will say all the time is that it has created this extreme suspicion within their own communities, within their own mosques, to the point where they're even afraid to talk to any new people about anything significant, because they fear quite rightly that this is all being done as part of a government effort to watch them. And it doesn't really matter whether it's true in a particular case or it isn't true. This climate of fear creates limits around the behavior in which they're willing to engage in very damaging ways. But I think what this surveillance state really does, more so than making people consciously aware of the limits, and those two examples that I just described, people not wanting to go to Occupy movements and people in Muslim communities being very guarded, is it makes people believe that they're free, even though they've been subtly convinced that there are things that they shouldn't do that they might want to do. I always use dog examples. I have 11 dogs, so it's one of the things that I do know best. And I know you probably think I'm crazy, and maybe I am, but they're all rescue dogs, and so it's just one of the things that we do. And so I know dog behavior really well, and so I draw lessons a lot from dogs. And one of the things that's really amazing about dog behavior is if you don't want dogs to go into a certain place because it's dangerous for them, one of the things that you can do is put a fence around the area where you want to confine them. But eventually, you can remove the fence, and you don't need the fence anymore because they will have been trained that the entirety of their world is within the boundaries that you first set for them. So even once you remove the fence, they won't venture beyond it. They've been trained that that's the only world that they want or are interested in or know. There are studies in what was formerly East Germany, which was probably one of the most notorious surveillance states of the last 50 years, where even once their boundaries were removed, once the Stasi no longer existed, once the wall fell, the psychological effects on the East German people endure until today. Because the way in which they've been trained for decades to understand that there are limits to their life, even once you remove the limits, they've been trained that those are not limits they need to transgress. And that's one of the things that constantly surveilling people and constantly communicating to them that they're powerless before this omnipotent government corporate institution does to people. It convinces them that the tiny little box in which they live is really the only box in which they want to live, so they no longer even realize they're being imprisoned. Rosa Luxemburg at that best, she said, "He who does not move does not notice his chains. He who does not move does not notice his chains." You can acculturate people to believing that tyranny is freedom, that their limits are actually emancipation. And that is what this surveillance state most insidiously does, is by training people to accept their own conformity, that they are actually free. They no longer even realize the ways in which they're being limited. So the last point I just want to mention, and we can talk about this, I'm sure, in the discussion that follows, and probably will, it's usually what this discussions afterward entail, is what can be done about all of this. And there are just a few quick points that I want to make about that. One is that you can do things that remove yourself from the surveillance matrix, not completely, but to the best extent you can. There are people who only engage in transactions using cash. As inconvenient as that is, it at least removes that level of surveillance. There are ways to communicate on the internet using very effective forms of anonymity, which I will talk about in a minute. There's ways of educating yourself about how to engage in interaction and activism beyond the prying eye of the US government, to say, in essence, a step ahead. There are important ways to educate yourself about the rights that you have when directly interacting with government agents. So much of what the government learns about people is because they let them learn that without having any legal obligation to do so. So much of government searches or government questioning is done under the manipulative pretext of consent, where people thought they had to consent or didn't know they had the right to, and give up information that they didn't need to give up. And educating yourself about what your rights are by going to the Center for Constitutional Rights website or the National Coalition to Protect Civil Freedoms or the ACLU, lots of places online will tell you how to do that. a very important means of subverting this one-way mirror that I've described is forcible, radical transparency. It's one of the reasons that I support so enthusiastically and unqualifiably groups like Anonymous and WikiLeaks. I want holes to be blown in the wall of secrecy. The way in which this ends up operating effectively is only because they're able to conceal what they do, and that's why they consider these unauthorized means of transparency so threatening. And then the last point I want to make about things that can be done is there are groups that are pursuing very interesting and effective forms of anonymity on the internet. There's things like the Tor Project and other groups which enable people to use the internet without any detection from government authorities. That has the effect of preventing regimes that actually bar their citizens from using the internet from doing so, since you can no longer trace the origins of the internet user. But it also protects people who live in countries like ours, in which the government is constantly trying to monitor what we do by sending our communications through multiple proxies around the world in a way that can't be invaded. There's really a war taking place, an arms race, where the government and these groups are attempting to stay one technological step ahead of the other in terms of technological ability to shield internet communications from the government and the government's ability to invade them, and participating in this war in ways that are supportive of the good side are really critical, as is availing yourself of the technology that exists to make what you do as private as possible. I really don't think there's many more important fronts of battle, if there are any, than combating the surveillance state. So that's why I'm so interested in the topic and why I'm so happy to be able to speak with you.
That was Glenn Greenwald giving a speech in Chicago called Challenging the Surveillance.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.